My name's Graham Foulkes. I'm the father of David Foulkes, who was killed in the 7/7 attack in London in 2005. We live in Greater Manchester, and David, who was 22 at the time, had travelled to London. This was his first time on his own and the first time he'd ever travelled on the tube. And he stood next to Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the leader of the bombers, who set his bomb off at Edgware Road, and David was killed.
So, I mean, what we've got is these two different terrorist incidents. Obviously, the 7/7 one was far greater. But, I mean, we've had the Manchester Inquiry reporting today. And I must admit, when I heard it on the radio, I'm thinking, even though the presenter was saying, well, this has never happened before, MI5 apologising, this kind of thing. Part of the inquiry, of course, is behind closed doors. So it's not really a public inquiry because the public are not allowed to see what's going on. So I wonder, you know, what you felt today hearing that news.
It was a real sense of deja vu because, although the 7/7 attack was a little while ago now, following the inquest into that attack, what I heard today was exactly the same that we heard after the inquest into 7/7. MI5 missed the opportunity. MI5 are very sorry. They couldn't tell us quite what had happened because it was secret and it would threaten the nation. Very convenient excuse for them. We heard a number of recommendations about how easy it is, or a number of comments about how easy it is to simply, in this country, to go and buy materials from which you can make a bomb. Exactly the same as 7/7. In the Manchester attack, we heard how the emergency services were pretty dismal in their response, disconnected, disorientated, disorganised. Exactly the same as after 7/7. No change, no improvements. And Manchester attack, sadly, we know a number of people lost their lives who could well have been saved had the emergency services followed the recommendations from the inquest into 7/7. It's quite shocking, really, to think that they just completely ignored it, because it seems to me, as I heard today, oh, these things never happen, they're very rare, we don't need to do anything. Well, and that's exactly what happened. I repeat.
I don't think most people realise what recommendations were made after 7/7 and whether or not our chief constables and our fire chiefs around the country followed them. Because, of course, firefighters are not just firefighters. They're also extremely well-qualified first aiders. They're dealing day-to-day with car crashes and things like that. So they are incredibly valuable people to have around. And one of the things that's so extraordinary about the Manchester attack is that the police cordon that was thrown around the venue excluded the firefighters from the scene for at least half an hour, something up to three quarters of an hour.
Well, I wasn't at all surprised to hear that, because in London, for example, at Edgware Road, where my son was killed, we know that the fire brigade arrived and were told to sit on the curb and do nothing for, I think, 15 minutes, because the police, the fire brigade and the ambulance services didn't know what was happening, weren't able to communicate with each other. So there in London, many of the first responders, and as you say, the people actually in the fire engines, actually in the police cars, are really well trained, but were unable to do anything because they didn't have any command structure in place. And that's exactly what happened in Manchester. But the thing that I found really frustrating is, following the 7/7 attacks, there was something called the Joint Emergency Services Interconnectivity Process was developed, and that was sent out to all chief constables and all the 43 forces in Britain, to all the fire brigades, to all the paramedics, and gave very clear instructions on the events of a major incident, not just a terrorist attack, but a major incident, how the command and control and communication system should work. A year before Manchester, that process was audited nationally, and shockingly was found that although the senior officers, chief constables and chief executives of the Ambulance Trust, knew about it, they didn't put in place any training, they didn't tell anybody that the system existed. So the day-to-day operational staff didn't even know that such a process of interconnectivity, so they could all work together, didn't even know it existed, let alone had any training. So that report was written a year before Manchester. It was highlighted to all the senior people that should know these things, and they did nothing about it. And when Manchester happened, exactly as predicted in this report, happened. Chaos. People not going to where they should do. Fire brigade not being allowed into the service. Paramedics not being allowed into the service. And people died. It's absolutely shameful.
Well, Salman Abedi, the bomber in Manchester, he was reported, I noticed, to the anti-terrorist hotline several months before the attack. So there was somebody, a member of the public, or maybe even several, flagging up to the security services, literally directly picking up the phone and telling them, you've got to keep an eye on this guy, he's a nutter.
Well, again, that's deja vu from London 7-7, because the leader of the 7-7 attack, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, was known to the security services for 2 years. They had followed him on training camps in North Wales. They'd followed him on training camp. This is with the other bombers, training camps in the Lake District. And I don't know if you remember, before 7-7, there was a fertilizer bomb plot. 650 kilos of fertilizer as a single bomb were discovered. And a chap called Omar Khayyam, I think his name was arrested and is currently in prison. And as part of that attack, it was known by the security services that Mohammed Sadiq Khan was involved, and yet they took no action. So I'm not surprised that with Abadi, MI5 made the same mistakes, because they're proving themselves to be pretty, well, lacking in some areas of their job, don't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, we've had this, what they've said is an unprecedented apology. I mean, I'm not so sure it is. I've seen this sort of thing happen myself on other terrorist attacks, such as the London Bridge attack. There was some security service apologies for that. What do you, as someone who's lost your son as a victim of a terrorist attack, make of these apologies that they issue?
Oh, do you know, that's the one thing that really upsets me more than anything, is that somebody sits behind a desk, somebody's selected, you sunshine, you can go make the apology. They sit behind the desk and they read out a statement prepared by the lawyers to make sure it's as safe as possible, and they think, oh, that's it, job done, we can move on now. It's appalling, isn't it? Who's been disciplined? Who's been sacked? Where's the proof that any processes have changed, been improved? And that we're more secure with the result of the knowledge that, of the failings now than we were before. What possible use is a man sitting behind a desk saying, we're really sorry?
I mean, it does look as if these security services are a law unto themselves. There's very little oversight, even through the Intelligence and Security Committee, because obviously the MPs aren't in the loop. They don't know, various procedures. They're not allowed to know what's going on within MI5, MI6, GCHQ. So it's very difficult, even for those MPs that are on that tiny committee, to really oversee these organisations.
Well, I think we've got to accept that the work they do is very sensitive and needs to be kept secure. But what needs to be checked, and I'm not convinced at all that it is that the processes and the decision-making algorithms that they follow are sound. And as a result of the processes being sound, they're making the correct decisions, because it seems to me they're not making the correct decisions. And it's the decision-making, not the casework that they're handling, but the decision-making processes seem to be need some kind of revision, an overview. And I'm not at all convinced that the Security Council made up of MPs, for goodness sake. I'm not convinced at all that they're actually holding the people to account properly.
Yeah, well, I wonder whether, I mean, obviously they use a lot of, you're right, algorithms to make decisions about interventions. Wouldn't it maybe be better to use a card index system and human beings making these decisions?
Well, I can't comment on that, because I don't know how they arrive at these decisions, but they seem to be making some very poor decisions. And it's all right saying they're just poor decisions, but that's 52 people in London, 22 in Manchester. So that's what, 74 people plus the other attacks in London. So we're upwards of 100 people that have died as a result of terrorists and poor decision making by the security services.
Graham, do you think you're a lone voice, or is it that other victims of families are afraid to speak out, or what do you think? What do you think of that? You know, is there a general disquiet amongst the families of victims of these attacks, do you think?
Well, I know for a fact, I'm in contact with a great number of them, and we have our own little groups, and it's very clear that we're all upset, but it really is a case of what can we do? Nobody listens. After 7-7, for example, and the inquest, I had a personal meeting with the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, and in her office in London, and went through the report with her and said, why don't anybody, at this moment, anybody can walk into a wholesaler and buy 10 kilos of hydrogen peroxide without any questions being asked. That's not the case in the rest of Europe. Why aren't we doing something about it? And she said, oh, it's too hard. It would be too hard to do. I asked her about the interconnectivity of the emergency services, and she said, oh, yes, we're working on that. Well, we saw what happened in Manchester, didn't we? So I think we're all of that mind that what can you do?
How would you answer that question yourself? Because something clearly needs to change, doesn't it, Graham?
Oh, gosh. The problem is there's no votes in it. MPs are vote chasers, aren't they? And there's no votes in making a whole hullabaloo about being the MP that's holding the security services to account. How does that appeal to any individual constituency voter? It doesn't. So that's, I think that's the real problem there. And it, and that needs to be addressed.
But look, you're right. I mean, something does need to change, even if it's to float the idea of some changes. So if you were made Home Secretary for a day, what would you do?
From the security services point of view, I'd sit the emergencies. I think the first problem, MI5 and MI6 are two separate organisations, and the police are separate organisations. Each of the police, 42 police areas, the chief constable, have a terrorist squad. That's a recipe for disaster, isn't it? There needs to be a single body that has national control and gathers the database in one place rather than four or five separate databases. That's what I'd do. I'd knock some heads together and set up a single agency.
Okay, Graham Faulks, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.